Financial services is fucking massive, so large, yet people loathe it. People hate their banks, they hate their insurance company, they hate their brokerage. And ultimately, I think what we believe is that that status quo, that equilibrium cannot stand.
That's Daniel Kimmerling. He's the founder of Desiance Capital, one of the OGs of fintech. Before he got into venture capital, he founded Standard Treasury, which was the very first banking as a service company. On this episode of Crafted, Dan shares how he identified the opportunity after meeting the founders of Twilio and Stripe.
That was a pretty mind-blowing conversation for me.
We'll also discuss why timing is everything.
From an ego perspective, I love being right. From a financial perspective, I love being right at the right time.
What he looks for when choosing which startups to back.
You have to invest into change. You cannot invest into stasis.
And why tectonic shifts are not always moneymakers for startups.
It's not that like generative AI is not cool. As a dweeb, it's fucking cool as hell. I got it. But then the question is, how the fuck are you going to make a dime?
Welcome to Crafted, a show about great products and the people who make them. I'm Dan Blumberg. I'm a product and growth leader, and Crafted is my main gig now. I'm here to bring you stories of founders, makers, and innovators that reveal how they built game-changing products and how you can, too. Crafted is sponsored by Artium, a next-generation software development consultancy that combines elite human craftsmanship and artificial intelligence. See how Artium can help you build your future at artium.ai. What was it that first drew you to tech?
Well, I've always been a nerd. And I think like a lot of people of my generation, the second renaissance of Steve Jobs was very inspiring. But then I didn't think I was going to go into tech, Dan. You know, where I grew up in New Jersey, a career in tech was not really a thing. If you were a smart Jewish kid from Central Jersey in the 90s, doctor or lawyer, those were the real options. And I was good at science, but I wasn't really good at science. So I guess I was going to go be a lawyer.
But after getting burned out while simultaneously getting a BA and a master's at University of Chicago, Dan decided to take a year off. And a funny thing happened.
And I remember reading this article in a printed version of Wired magazine about Mike Arrington and TechCrunch. And I recall them saying that Mike Arrington was the new Silicon Valley kingmaker. I'd never heard of a blog before. I'd never read TechCrunch. I'd never heard of TechCrunch. And a couple weeks or whatever later, Mike wrote a post being like, I need help. If you're like a young whippersnapper, email me. And I did. And he called me up a couple weeks later. And he's like, I don't know if you can be in Atherton on Monday. You got the job. That's how I got into tech. Very simple.
Awesome.
No brilliant insight or like grand strategic plan. I thought I'd do it for a little bit, go to law school. But when you are with entrepreneurs all day, you get a lot of that energy. And you're like, I could write about cool shit, or I could just do cool shit. And writing about cool shit is not nearly as cool as doing cool shit. And that, I think, really planted the seed.
That's awesome.
You know, like where I grew up, the idea that a kid would like raise millions of dollars and start companies and like one of the greatest things that Y Combinator has ever done, and you know, I'm a YC alum, I did YC in 2013, is that it created an acceptable alternative career trajectory for a certain kind of person. People who went to Stanford or Cal, they knew what it was to start startups.
Right.
For people who from back east or maybe abroad, that wasn't in the lexicon. And YC kind of created a bit of a finishing school where it became socially acceptable. And I give PG a lot of credit. And I think one of the reasons why EC or the startup ecosystem will be very vibrant for many years to come is because there is this alternative career trajectory.
Fast forward to 2008, and Dan met Jeff Lawson, the co-founder of Twilio.
And that was a pretty mind-blowing conversation for me.
Thanks to APIs that Twilio built, it was easy for product makers to add phone calls or text messages to their applications. Side note, it's thanks to Twilio's APIs and the presence of one of their developer evangelists at a hackathon in 2011 that I was able to co-found and quickly build Seen Near Me, an app that alerted you via text message if you checked in, remember Foursquare check-ins, if you checked in near the site of a famous movie shoot. Anyway, Dan Kemmerling saw very early on that embedding was going to be big. And then he met John and Patrick Collison, the co-founders of Stripe.
They're next level. And I had seen what they were doing with credit card acceptance, what you would call merchant acquiring. And I was like, there's so much more that banks do beyond the purview of Stripe. Stripe is incredible, but it's kind of, at least circa 2008, 2009, 2010, it was very focused on merchant acquiring. And I was like, there's so much more that banks can do. We should go start what we would now call a banking as a service business. Like Twilio is a telephony as a service business.
Yep.
And there were companies like Parse, which are infrastructure as a service businesses. There will have to be a banking as a service business. And that was ultimately the seed behind Send Your Treasury.
Can you give an example of how in, sounds like it's 2014 or so, like someone would have been using the APIs that you built at Standard Treasury? Like what would be the service the end user would get and what were the players that were involved?
Yeah, well, Dan, let's just say you wanted to build an app such that people could list houses to rent. And to do that, you would need to collect a form of payment when somebody makes a reservation. You would need to escrow that payment. And then when the stay was complete, that escrow would have to be completed. And if there's like a cross-border dimension, there would have to be some FX in there and so on and so forth. And so while the app might be about helping people list their home for rent, really what this is like a complex financial plumbing problem. And so you needed a similarly powerful set of APIs that allow developers to build these apps and create the workflows and experiences they want. And what you kind of come to see is that to some degree, everything is a financial plumbing problem. You know, one of our beliefs at Decians is that financial services is actually way larger and more important than people think, because it is one of the critical underlying enabling technologies of modernity. And so once everyone has one of these and they're used to like basically doing everything on their smartphone in these app environments, app developers need powerful financial tools, like they need a powerful telephony tools.
Yeah.
And so that's why, you know, closing that circle.
Yeah. I met with someone at MasterCard recently who you know, used the analogy that like Uber couldn't exist without the financial tools that we're talking about right now.
Connecting buyers and sellers requires actually a surprising amount of financial infrastructure.
Yeah. I'm interested, with Standard Treasury, you had absolutely the right insight. API-driven banking is going to be huge. You were very early. It was the very first banking as a service company. I'm curious, what did that experience teach you and how do you apply those lessons today about the right technology and the right time? And as an investor today, how do you apply those lessons?
Well, I certainly, from an ego perspective, I love being right. From a financial perspective, I love being right at the right time. Being right at the wrong time from an economic perspective is indistinguishable from being wrong.
Yep.
And so you're always looking for some kind of catalyst, right? So like a core theory we have at Decians is that you have to invest into change. You cannot invest into stasis. So if we look at our portfolio, pretty much every single investment we have made has as a core theory something that is changing about the background that the company we invest in operates in. I'll just give an easy example. We have a company called BeatBread. BeatBread finances musicians and works with musicians. And the core macro change which is happening is that there's Spotify and iTunes and YouTube and TikTok and all these next-gen music distribution solutions. And that fundamentally changes the economic necessity of record labels, because I don't know about you, Dan, but I don't get most of my music at Tower Records anymore. You know,
I was more of an HMV guy back in the day, but yeah, very well taken point.
Yeah, and that's like a very easy example, but you want to invest into change. So that's like one thing. The second thing is, if you're uncertain about the timing, operate in a maximally conservative posture. So in a world where timing is uncertain, spend as little as possible so you can survive as long as possible till you are confident that the timing is right. You know, if you're too early, spending a lot of money is not going to help you. Gartner has this whole idea of the adoption curve.
Mm-hmm.
And I will butcher Gartner's language, but there's like the extreme early adopters, the early adopters, the middle early adopters, the mid adopters, et cetera. And Standard Treasury really found a niche in the like extreme early adopters. But to go from extreme early adopters to early adopters, you know, might have taken a couple years. And we were not capitalized and we didn't operate in a way that would have given us sufficient longevity to go after that. And in different industries and at different times, the willingness to be early or late in that cycle changes. You know, I can't say that the banking industry is known for being the most assertive early adopters, you know, bleeding edge adopters.
So. Yeah, that sounds familiar with the experience I had working and innovating inside of some big banks. Can you share the origin story of Decians and the types of companies, types of stages that you invest in?
Yeah. So the second question is actually quite straightforward. Decians invests in financial services businesses, of which fintech is one subcategory. And we do so at the earliest stages, and we hope to be a fulsome partner to them over their entire life cycle. You know, what I would say about why I started Decians, God only knows that we don't need more fucking venture capitalists on this planet. I mean, there's so many VCs and a lot of good ones, but we need more entrepreneurs as a society. But what I saw with Decians was really two things. The first is many of the people I looked up to had started small firms that could work with entrepreneurs like on day one. And, you know, they could write that like $1 million to $3 million check that you need to get going. But ultimately, their funds had grown. And in venture capital, there's a kind of what I would call industrial logic. You need to deploy a certain number of dollars per year into a certain number of companies in order to kind of stay on plan. And if you have a $100 million fund, which is kind of the size of our funds, then you need to be writing 4-ish checks a year into 3-ish million dollars.
Mm-hmm.
If you have an $800 million fund, you know, it's just 8 times more. Are you going to write 32 checks a year? That's a lot. Or are you going to just write bigger, every time you do an investment, are you going to write a bigger check? And therefore, because you're writing a bigger check, you have to move later stage. And so the industrial logic of venture capital suggests that if you really want to do early stage, you have to stay small and you have to really fight the temptation to grow. And so that was like one of the reasons I started Decians, is I saw many of my friends, peers, mentors, one generation ahead of me getting much larger very quickly and therefore structurally positioning themselves out of the early stage game. Second, I loved the people who invested in Standard Treasury. Some of them are still very good friends of mine, and they're investors in our funds, co-investors with us, and so on. But I always felt like, while the people cared about me, my team, and our mission, we were relatively small fries economically to them. Like, we were not economically important to them. And as a entrepreneur, I want our success to really be important to the people who invest in us. And part of the theory of Decians is that every company has to be important to us. We're a small fund. We don't invest in that many deals. So each and every company really matters. Each and every founder really matters. I want it to really matter to us economically, personally, emotionally, and so on. And so a big thing with Decians is that has to be our core ethos, and the incentives have to be aligned.
What are the characteristics that you look for in an early founding team, or whether it's sector-based? What do you look for when deciding whether to make an investment?
Yeah, so we're 7 years into Deciens, and we've seen on average 900 deals a year, and on average we do three or four. And that's a very chaotic process. And to manage that chaos, we've had to create a framework. And within that framework, there are kind of like three big components. There's the team, the opportunity, and the deal. You were asking specifically about the team, so let's maybe start there. What we're really looking for are three core kind of like sociological phenomena in these teams. First is we're looking for people who have insane levels of fortitude and resilience. I can't tell you that every startup will work, but I can't tell you that every startup's going to suck. And so you have to just like be willing to embrace a level of physical, emotional, financial, psychological, spiritual pain and keep going. Just keep fucking going. Day after day after day, year after year after year. And most people don't have that. And so what you're really looking for are people that do have it. And you're looking for people that have a track record of doing it. The second is we're looking for what we would call variant perspective. There are a lot of problems in the world, and I think many of the biggest problems are actually quite well known. It's not the problems that are novel. It's the solutions that are novel. So we're looking for people that have non-obvious, or what we would call variant perspective, on solutions to enduring problems. The third piece of the puzzle is we're looking for people that have accomplished a lot relative to the resources they have. Doing a lot with a lot of resources is great, but what we're looking for are people that, like, I don't know if your audience has watched MacGyver, the like, you know, the old school television show.
Yeah.
But we're looking for people like MacGyver who, with just like basically chewing gum, duct tape, and two nickels, you know, can make something happen.
Yeah. And I'm sure you're looking for that even more now in this market than you might have been a few years ago.
Yeah, for sure. I think what I would just say is part of having this MacGyver-like capacity to do something with nothing, embedded in that is a high degree of adaptability. You know, a couple of years ago, existential financing risk was caused by not growing fast enough. And so you saw like lots of companies like doing everything they could to grow as fast as possible so they could mitigate existential financing risk. Right now, existential financing risk comes from being unprofitable. And so therefore, you know, the people that will survive going from one era to the next are those that are most adaptable. And, you know, this MacGyver-like quality, being able to do a lot with a little, being able to survive no matter, you know, and push and keep going, these are all kind of around this concept of adaptability.
Yeah. I want to ask you about the technology of the moment of generative AI and all things AI. You have a post on your site, a Deciens site, in which you write, "The behavior of a lot of venture capitalists towards the LLM space baffles us. We've seen VCs beg founders to take their money without a clear understanding of how real the innovations are, whether a specific technology will be impactful and how they will monetize, and that their justification is that AI is the next platform and it's, you know, it's just going to be huge, and but they don't do a lot of stress testing." Paraphrasing a bit. I'd love if you could share more about what the irrational behavior that you see and how you approach that space and others in a way that may be different from other VCs out there.
So there's a quite old book called A Brief History of Financial Euphoria, which talks about the fact that humans are able to go from one form of speculative excess to another form of speculative excess almost instantaneously without any regard for the fact that like it's self-evidently economically destructive. And I think VCs as a industry, we succumb to that phenomena. I was with someone the other day who said that there's no more powerful force than VCs feeling FOMO, feeling the fear of missing out. And I get it, right? Like if you think that the job of a venture capitalist is to deploy capital so that they can raise more capital, then deploying into the flavor of the week with buzzy marketing messages makes total sense, right? Because it is something that they can then market to their clients and raise bigger funds around. I totally get it. It's totally economically rational. I think we have this perspective that ultimately our careers and the success or failure of the firm will be governed not by our ability to raise capital, but by our ability to return capital. And it's a lot harder to return capital. And, just with this LLM example, in that piece, we talk about the fact that we think a lot of the foundational models and underlying critical technologies, the economics will either be dissipated through paying the NVIDIAs and hyperscale data center providers, so the Google, Microsoft, and Amazons mm-hmm. of the world, or the innovations will be in the open source community, and that will ultimately erode the ability of solution providers to charge commensurate amounts for their solutions. And so a big question, it's not that like generative AI is not cool. As a dweeb, it's fucking cool as hell. I got it. But then the question is, how the fuck are you going to make a dime on it? And that's really the question I think a lot of people don't really have a good answer to. They don't even have a good theory. And, there are like all these claims around how large OpenAI is. But then the question is, are they just paying NVIDIA all that money, right? And ultimately, a big problem with this whole class of problems is that I think they're going to be quite low margin businesses.
So when you founded Standard Treasury, it was based on an observation that APIs were going to be really big and they're going to be huge businesses built on embedded finance and embedded lots of things. And that insight, led you to found the company. And I'm interested, what insights do you have today? What observations are you making that you're placing bets on with future companies? What are you optimistic about that you see coming around the bend?
I'm extremely optimistic about a lot of things our portfolio is doing. Of course, what VC doesn't want to talk about their own book? For all of our snark and cynicism around AI, there is some really cool stuff happening. Just we have to figure out how to make money doing it.
Yeah.
I think right now what I'm most interested in is looking at what is the future of venture capital itself. And for any of your listeners who haven't, I strongly recommend the book Power Law by Sebastian Mallaby. And it kind of is the best history of venture capital in the United States. And that has really inspired me to think about what is the boom-bust nature of venture capital itself? And how does Desians have a deeper, better, more fulsome understanding of that cyclical nature and build interesting venture capital businesses around it? So I think that's a lot of what we've been working on the last 6 to 12 months.
And are there particular technological changes or societal changes or tea leaves that you're reading now as you envision what financial services might look like, several years into the future?
Dan, financial services is fucking massive, so large, yet people loathe it. People hate their banks. They hate their insurance company. They hate their brokerage, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
And ultimately, I think what we believe is that status quo, that equilibrium cannot stand. We cannot have such a large industry in which people hate it. And entrepreneurs will always be looking to create new, surprising, and delightful solutions. And I think where the biggest opportunities are is in places where traditional financial institutions simply do not serve their constituencies well. And as much as I do deeply appreciate the large money center banks, they really serve a very median audience. And we have a number of companies in our portfolio that are attempts to identify the opportunities that are far outside of that middle lane. And thankfully, because of the power of the internet, the search and distribution costs for those opportunities is way lower than it would have been in an analog era.
Got it. The personalization of, financial services for
podcasters who live in Hudson Valley.
Yeah, there certainly are tools for creators, capital C creators. God help me, I think I'm one of them now. So exactly, yes. A mutual friend of ours tells me that you have an uncanny ability to help people and to help make connections, and that you do it in a really genuine way. And I'm interested to hear how you do it. Is there a method to helping others that you think maybe others can learn from?
I don't know who this mutual friend is, but whomever it is, they're very kind. I think that there are just like really three things. First is an ethos of giving first. If you give first, I'm confident, I don't know if it's karma or whatever, but I'm confident that if I give first, it will come back to me in spades. Maybe not tomorrow, but in the fullness of time. Second is I try and study more about other problems than the problems I work on. Just as an example, I do financial services, venture capital, but I read very widely and I try and learn very widely about the world, people, history, culture, and so on. And I think that that helps me try and find connections which are maybe not obvious or not as obvious to others. And then I think the third thing is that I'm insanely OCD about my inbox and about my kind of record-keeping system, which is to say that I do not go to sleep ever without a zero inbox. Every day, before I go to sleep, I go through all of the calls, all of the texts, all of the meetings, and I do all of my follow-up before the end of the day, every day. And my wife knows it. She knows I simply will not go to bed if I've not done all of my follow-ups. And I think that that creates a kind of, I don't know if it's a culture, a system, but it's just how I've been for years. Whether I am more helpful to people or not, I don't know. But I think it creates an impression that, and I'm not perfect. Like I can't say that I've never dropped an email or whatever. And if somebody's listening and they emailed me and I didn't respond, please forgive me. But I want people to get back to me. So I want to get back to people. And I think that creates the right ethos.
Yeah. And I'm sure it also, I mean, there's the old adage that time kills all deals, right? So I'm sure that just the rapid iteration of keeping a conversation going also has its own sort of more times at bat benefit.
For sure. And I think about all the people who helped me. You know, we as a firm stand on the shoulders of giants. We all people stand on their forefathers and foremothers. And I never want to forget that. And you know, this job, my job as a venture capitalist is fucking insanely privileged. It's got to be one of the most privileged jobs out there. And I never want to abuse that privilege. And I think helping others is one of a number of ways in which we try and you know, as I mentioned before, we see like, I don't know, 900-ish deals a year and we do like three or four. And that means for most people, we're not going to give them money. But that doesn't mean we can't send an email, make a connection, try and be a good human about it.
Yeah.
Even if it means that we can't write very capable people checks.
Dan, thank you so much. I really appreciate all the things you've shared today. This is really fascinating.
Of course, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much, Dan.
That's Daniel Kimmerling, and this is Crafted, a show about great products and the people who make them. I'm Dan Blumberg, and it would mean a lot if you could share this episode with a friend. Crafted is sponsored by Artium, a next-generation software development consultancy that combines elite human craftsmanship and artificial intelligence. See how Artium can help you build your future at artium.ai.
You have to be willing to embrace a level of physical, emotional, financial, psychological pain and just keep fucking going.